hearing of order for today night of the Spring 12 hearing. Scott's in the panel. We're here for Elmsby Farms Limited, I take it.
We are.
Thank you very much. You know the team. So, probably with no further ado, I'd invite you, Scott, to tell us how you'd like to proceed.
Three or four housekeeping matters to the building suit, and then largely we are relying on obviously the materials that we seek that have been taken as read. We'll appreciate that some reasonably detailed legal submissions, most of which I haven't seen the comments on again. I'd just like to make some questions, but I'm not going to be talking for a very long time, but I'll highlight a few issues. We have the summaries that I explained in the last paragraph of my legal submissions. They're mostly reasonably short, two or three pages. We have a full base set down for this. Certainly the case to be presented isn't going to take any here before that. I expect how long will take will probably more depend on how many questions there are and how long they take to answer.
Can I say at the outset, feel free to sit down. I do know that some council prefer to stand, but it's entirely up to
you. I'm one of those I prefer to stand. Brains half a race just down when I sit down, so used to being on the feet. Anyway, as I said, plenty of time for questions, and we look forward to explaining any aspects of the case which need explaining. I do have some of the handout at the beginning. Someone could
Are we up to number 23, Steve?
Yeah.
Sorry. Excuse me, there's a few there for that. It's not letting them hand around, so I've handed up two items. The first, you'll recollect in the legal submissions, there was attached to my legal submissions a draft easement agreement. My legal submissions advised that it would be executed. Yes. So I've now circulated a copy of that easement agreement fully executed by the parties.
Is the text the same as the draft attached to your submission?
A couple of minor tweaks, a couple of corrections. And I don't intend to address that any further. It's there, and you may have some questions about it, but I'll rely on my explanation of it as any other my written submissions.
While we're at it, I have one question arising out of the easement, and that's about condition two. I read 2A, 2-1A. As saying that if the zone is not confirmed as a term sought, then the easement doesn't apply. Is that a correct reading?
No, sir. I was actually fairly careful with my wording there.
Yes, I was. A question.
A is, and perhaps I can clarify, A is that the rural lifestyle zone is confirmed and inserted, and then secondly, the subdivision consent is obtained and implemented in full and part.
I got the second one. The question is, if we should form the view that there should be a variation in the terms of the zone sought, so for instance, one of the things that I had in mind to ask Mr. White is about the activity status of various actions in terms of the zone provisions. Is that the zone, well, that's no longer your proposed zone, it's something different. So does that mean that the condition is triggered and we can't rely on the easement? That's the issue I want to get at, to understand.
I see your point, and can I say on that and anything else that might rise in that easing agreement, I may seek liberty after this hearing to perhaps a final variation or something. Change it. A says A Mount Zion Rural Lifestyle Zone rather than A that was proposed. The reason I mentioned the second condition, sir, is for example, another change the panel might be looking at all of the house sites and might have concerns with some of them, not others. The number might drop. Obviously, that changes the economic parameters of the proposal. But you get to B, you either, whatever zone you get, you either implement it or you don't. So that was the intention of the two stages.
Well, indeed. So can I suggest, respectfully, that you give further thought to how 2.1a is framed, that the word substantially might be used, and with a definition of what substantially means. Because I suspect, given our previous discussions and previous hearings, that one obvious definition of substantially is that you get 15 house sites out of it.
They set your invitation, sir, but I will resist defining a number of houses.
Yes.
Because there isn't a level. I can't honestly say, well, 12 yes, 11 no, or whatever. Obviously, there would be a point at which the landowner might decide it's not within the zone, which is why it wouldn't be. I don't want to be perceived as constraining the panel's ability to exercise its judgment by saying, well, you know, we're asked for 12 new ones, at least 10 you're on, 9 you're not. I really don't want to provide that kind of constraint in the numbers.
Well, is your intention effectively that it's all or nothing? But that you're in the sense of, if it goes ahead in some way, shape or description, as evidenced by the subdivision, then the easement will apply.
Correct. If the zone is easement.
Can I suggest to you it doesn't currently say that? Because they're framed as separate conditions.
Well, they both have to apply.
Well, yes, as so. If you could think about the drafting.
Yes.
Because and my concern is that your case is premised that we can rely on the easement if the development goes ahead, as I understand it. And I don't want to be in a clear stick where we find that because of the way that the easement is drafted, the benefits involved in the easement, because you're clearly relying on them, subject to your arguments about scope and discuss in due course, but I don't want to find out that in the fullness of time that expectation falls to ground not the way this is drafted.
Okay.
So yeah, so I think the way we leave it is you'll hold on that one.
The second document I handed out, Commissioners, this is more than a matter for ease of reference. I intend to refer to that plan shortly. It's the recreation plan that was attached to Mr. Galloway's presentation.
Well,
it's
this.
That's the last plan.
The very last one. So
it's separate. It's not part of the easement if you take that funding.
There's evidence by fact it's not on the same statement. Sure, obviously.
So it is a copy of the plan that was annexed to Dr. Galloway's evidence.
So I don't think we need that. We don't need an exhibit number because it's not a new document.
Correct.
Well, thank you.
Just, I'm going to talk to it so it's easier.
they will identify from where I live.
Third half section, we have to serve as a section of our legal solutions about process and actual justice. I don't think we address that further. I think it's a slightly unusual situation, and we would like the opportunity to respond to whatever the council says weekly, if appropriate, and I leave that to your judgment.
Can I observe that given that there is extensive council evidence saying what its position is on the merits, the idea that because council's legal submission doesn't traverse all of those merits arguments is significant. I thought it was a good try. Was it supposed to be the best way to put it?
I wasn't sure whether the omission was deliberate or accidental, Commissioner. Obviously, council has the scope to review the evidence presented and not necessarily agree with the case of their own witnesses.
True, and but I think in the absence of comment, you might assume that they do agree.
Possibly do. And if in fact the only final comment from the council is on jurisdictional matters, then any response should be very brief. I leave the request on the table.
Yeah.
Next, just two or three minor corrections to my written submissions, just so we get the record straight. As you have my written legal submissions, my prior submissions there.
The second one.
Part two. The longest week. On page 9, paragraph 24, little B. And then I got my easterns and westerns mixed. An area of 2.3 hectares on the western side of the SNA. And paragraph 26, just below the same correction, a western 2.3 area is different. Maybe you're confused. Page 25, paragraph 83, little B. You probably spotted that the third line could be particularised in S6-8, not 5.6-8, but section 6-8. And finally, on the next page, paragraph 88, second, third line, and two theological aspects, although that is covered separately by section 6C, not 6B. Fourth housekeeping matter, sir. Attached to my legal submission was a letter from Department of Conservation. Should the panel wish to put any questions to the Department of Conservation, we will be sitting up in the DOC office. If I could ask you to think about that, that's after lunch, we will arrange for a representative to come down and just answer any questions that you have.
I'll discuss that with the commissioners over lunch.
Thank you. Fifthly, I've already talked about my approach, so those are the housekeeping matters. I'm just going to talk to a few aspects of this proposal, and I'd like to start with talking about the objective. The objective here, in a nutshell, probably one of my legal submissions, is that we are actually trying to create a public park. Here. We're trying to have a public park comprising virtually the whole of Mount Ina, and trying to do so for the benefit of the Wanaka community at no cost to the Wanaka community. It is a significant objective, and we want the panel to underestimate the effort that has gone in to try to achieve that objective. I've drafted numerous plan provisions over my career. I don't think I've ever drafted a set of plan provisions that have required quite so much thought and effort as this particular set. The evidence lodged probably had version 25, and my legal submission had probably version 26 at hand. It is very difficult to achieve that objective in this forum, given there are certain things this panel can't do. has jurisdiction to do, like accept land on behalf of the council, which involves financial obligations. So trying to create that objective through a district plan review process is a challenge. I would like to submit to the panel that overriding objective simply hasn't been recognised or understood by the council, in the council case and in the council evidence. There is no reflection or understanding, and everything that I've read, of that overriding objective to create a public park to benefit the Wanaka. If I can draw it, I'm only going to refer to one page of the council's evidence. I'm going to refer to the same page three or four times. But Mr. Barr's evidence for the council, if you want to find it and tab this particular page, it will make life easier. Mr. Barr's evidence, page 49, page is an analysis and starts at paragraph 12.18 to 12.21 on that page. And I refer to Mr. Barr's paragraph 12.19, where he refers to the detail in the request of provisions. He commends them as being appropriate from a procedural mechanical perspective. And then he says, however, I consider that 8 pages of tailored objectives, policies, rules, and consent obligations for a rezoning that provides for 12 new residential units is extraordinary and excessive in terms of district planning drafting. In my submission, that statement demonstrates how the council isn't supported. It doesn't take 8 pages of drafting to create 12 rural lifestyle sites. If that was the objective, we'd ask for a rezoning, have a small structure plan, and a design control call. No objectives and policies needed in one page. And probably including the structure plan. But the 12 sites are a means to an end. The objective is how I describe it. And given the complexities of trying to achieve that objective, I said that this panel should have no concern about 8 pages of objectives, policies and rules. I don't know why there's a concern about length anyway. You know, we live in an electronic age and everybody just gets on the computer and things. Most people would have no idea how long the district plan is, because one goes to what one needs to go to. And I'll say at the end, I'm happy to engage with the panel on the detail of those provisions, but they are complex for a reason. The reason is the objective and the difficulty of achieving. Second point I'd like to make, commissioners, and here's where I refer you to the plan I circulated, the one for recreation map. I'd like you to look at that plan and look at the location now. I'm sure you're familiar with it. But if you look at that plan, you see Mount Iron, the Allenby lands, the original Allenby lands are slightly bluish colour, the Mount Iron recently purchased is a brownish colour, and the green with Mount Iron on it is the Dock Estate. The three of them comprise virtually all of Mount Iron except for the, I think Mr. Bass describes as the peri-urban development on the foot of the northern slopes, Hidden Hills and the like. But otherwise, those three areas comprise the whole of Mount Iron. To the left, we have the Wanaka CBD, Mount Aspiring College and the Primary School. To the north, we have where all the purple lines are, that's North Lake, PC 45, 1,500 houses consented, just starting to be developed now. To the east, we have Albertown, established residential areas. And to the south, purple again, we have Three Marks, which is zoned for, a large one. That's that whole area where the purple's going is zoned for development. Mount Iron is central to all of those urban, existing and future urban populations, right in the middle. And my submission that has two implications for this hearing. One of which is probably obvious, and one of which might be less so. The first relates to recreation. Clearly a major part of the case. Probably Galloway's, all of this evidence. I just highlight the contiguousness, the location of Mount Iron and the recreational opportunities within walking or a very short bike ride or drive to virtually the whole of Wellington, right in the middle. I invite the panel to consider the value of that kind of resource in the centre of an urban area. I can refer to Albert to Henley Park in Christchurch. Cornwall Park, North. Urban areas having a big central area of publicly accessible space for people to recreate is of immense value to urban areas. The second factor of that location is perhaps not quite so obvious. Mount Iron is a feature. It rises out of the plain in a very obvious manner. And it is experienced, if you haven't already done so, I imagine you will have, commissioners, but I invite you to, if you haven't, you spent 3 quarters of an hour this morning just driving around Wanaka. Mr. Baxter's photographs in hand, trying to work out where you could see Mount Iron from, what its aspects were, where you might or might not see a house or more from this proposal. But if you think about the fact that it's a circular, conical feature in the centre of an urban area, and you think about of all of the views of Mount Iron, just talking visually for a minute, all of the views of Mount Iron from all of the parts of Wanaka that can see Mount Iron, and then as a subset of that, think of how many views might be adversely affected to a greater or lesser degree by the proposed houses. I can't give you the calculation. I submit to you that it is very obvious that the percentage will be small. That's very small. I distinguish this from, hypothetical example, a zone on the Alpha Fan, the Cripple Range. There's now a fan there called the Alpha Fan. Now, if something happened there, the whole bunker looks at the Alpha Fan. Vast majority of Wanaka might see a view of something on the Alpha Fan. Mount Iron is different. Most viewers, there's the northeast quadrant, broadly, where you might see a view of one or more houses. There's three other quadrants where your visual experience of Mount Iron is completely unaffected. And my submission, that is a relevant consideration when you are considering the extent of any potential adverse effect on the visual experience of Mount Iron. Now, third point, commissioners, I'm going to touch briefly on the three legs of our case, as it were, landscape, ecological, and recreational. Starting with landscape, and again referring to the same page in Mr. Barr's evidence, which is kind of a summary page. Paragraph 12, 20, little a. Based on the opinions of council specialists, Mr. Barr concludes that the proposal would have adverse cumulative landscape effects on the Mount Iron ONF, a matter of national importance in terms of Section 16 of the Act. It highlights what I submit to you, commissioners, is an interesting aspect of this case. There's an element of artificiality around the Mount Iron ONF. Because, of course, the ONF doesn't include, in particular, the northern lower slopes where there is existing residential development and which are clearly part of the Mount Iron landscape. You will have seen in this original submission lodged for LMB that issue was actually addressed. And there was a submission point that Mount Iron should be identified as the landform it is, and the ONF boundary should go further downslope, and run around the bottom of the landfill, because Mount Iron is so clearly a landfill arising out of the plain. Now, having read the Council's Section 22 report and on reflection, we did not pursue that.
Can I clarify at that point? I've used that language has been used by other submitters. Does not pursue equal withdrawal, so that we are not required to make a decision on it, or is it merely that you have no evidence to support it and we do have to make a decision on it? Similarly, your other submission points not pursued regarding the UGB.
It's of no moment to our case, Commissioners. UGB, well, I'll probably leave there, because just to give you scope if you needed it. And I think part of our UGB submission was accepted, but we're not pursuing it. They've got the Hikawai Conservation Area. So I'll leave the UGB point there. The reason for not... I'll answer your question. The reason for not pursuing it is I came to the conclusion that the S23 report was right in that the way out of this district plan is structured, you can't have residential areas on an ONF or in an OHL because the objectives and policies don't match. They just, you create a discontinuity in the plan, discontinuity in the plan.
Is that indicative that the plan is wrong? In fairness, context of the question, we've asked the witnesses for the council questions regarding does the council get out of having to deal with Section 6 issues by just zoning land residential and therefore it can pretend therefore it's not outstanding?
Well, I would answer that point by submitting commissioners that certainly my understanding from many, many environmental cases, whether it's Jackson, you start up by classifying the landscape. And then you decide what the zone is. You can't do the other way around.
And you think an ONF would be the same path?
Yes, except that 2 points. One is, ONLs and ONFs are a bit different. ONLs, you have this debate about, there's often not a specific line. You've got to figure out where the line is on 3 or 4 different factors, topography, vegetation, development, and support, something else. And so you end up with kind of having to draw a line and a fuzzy band. ONFs actually are more distinct, usually, than River Gorge. Mount Iron. I mean, you drive around Mount Iron, but the edge of the landform is crystal clear. It's right at the bottom, most of it's got carnage. You drive along Aubrey Road, right beside the edge of Aubrey Road, there's a fence and there's carnage behind it, there's a hill going up. Anybody looking at that landform would say Mount Iron starts at the fence.
Well, I was very interested a few minutes ago when you made that comment about, I can understand in the context of a landscape, dwellings all over the countryside might affect the landscape values, but in the case of an ONF, I have to be honest, I struck the same observation you made, that just because there were houses on it, doesn't seem to take away from what was a pretty spectacular landfall.
Yes.
Or natural feature.
And that was the thinking when we drafted this measure. It's obvious.
So again, I go back to saying maybe it's a case that the council's got its plan wrong. If it's effectively not potentially recognising those ONFs because it's confused a zoning framework or policy directive with what the law requires.
Yes, there is a potential issue there. I kind of decided not to look into it deep because I did take the point in the council's written evidence that you have an objective and policy suite applicable to ONFs and you have an objective and policy suite applicable to urban residential areas, and it's kind of weird to have an urban residential area on an ONF when you have objectives and policies that clearly don't match the urban residential area. And therefore, possibly because planning, the purism of planning not have to give away the realities on the ground, I think the council, in terms of the way our district plan works, I think the council's approach is I can't imagine that they were correct when they said you can't put hidden hills on the ONF because the objectives and policies don't match. And I was kind of comfortable with that.
Given that
It's fair to say you cast a pretty long shadow on this part of the world. Our role does involve the opportunity to make recommendations to the council for future variations or things that in the course of our hearings we think might be improved upon. Is that a matter you think would fall into that category or not?
I'm pausing, Commissioner, because I would find that question a lot easier to answer if the Court of Appeal had heard the Davidson case and overturned the High Court. we're stuck with Davidson at the moment, and we're going down the track if Davidson is upheld, where the objectives and policies become critically important, because if we can't get it, you'll appreciate it, I'm running a part two, section 5 case. And if in the future we can't go to part 2 on resource consents, then there's going to be so much more significance on the drafting of the district plan. And my question, if I ask you a question, probably different which way that goes.
That particular point has occurred to us. Suffice it to say, we have assumed you're running the Part 2 case, and I will be interested to discuss with you the consistency of that position with Davidson, and as indeed I discussed with counsel for the council, whether her acceptance of that position was likewise consistent with Davidson, and while leave has been granted, given the, well, I'm sure the Court of Appeal will move with all due speed, the prospect that we will have a Court of Appeal decision before this panel has to deliver its recommendations, it would at best be slim.
Yes.
Given that, as I understand it, they haven't even fixed a timetable yet, unless there's a hearing date.
It isn't helpful to any of us. Coming back to your original question, did you make a recommendation that significantly changed the approach? I'm probably a bit more about that.
Well, think about it, because if the issue is, in your view, there's a strong case that, for instance, Mount Hyon, the feature starts at the bottom, and Section 6 requires those features to be recognised and certainly protected, etc., etc., etc. And the current plan approach doesn't do that by excluding bits of it because they have houses on it, then I think that would be something I'd very much appreciate your thoughts on. Maybe over lunch we'll think about it.
I think that's it. Anyway, that's where I was going. Accepting that we have
the before you go on, the other thing you can think about, is not just whether you recommend that we make a recommendation on the subject, but what would the substance of the recommendation be? Because it's not just yes or no. If the problem is a mismatch in policies, is the recommendation not just that the ONF be expanded, but that the objectives and policies applicable to residential zones on ONFs likewise be reopened to remove the inconsistency? So, as I say, just add that to the thing you were wondering about.
Going back to the theme of my quote, I think Mr. Barr's paragraph 12.20a talks about adverse effects on the ONF, repeats that in two or three other places in his evidence. I think it's a fair summary of Ms. Melsop's landscape evidence, but it creates an artificiality, because when you are considering the effects on the Mount Hyon ONF as defined, which doesn't include the houses on the northern slope, are not a relevant factor in your assessment of the effects on the ONF. So you're, and I accept under 6B, you didn't do this. If that's the ONF, you have to look at the effects on the ONF, And as it stands, on this ONF as defined, there are no houses. No, sorry. There are three houses on the Elmley property, and there's one approved building platform on the Mount Lyon property. But apart from those four, there are no houses. So when you do your 6B consideration and you're looking at effects on the ONF, all of that is entirely valid. But there is then a real world system. Because quite frankly, in every photograph, in all the stacks of photographs where you might possibly see one or more of our proposed houses, you can see all the slopes of Mount Iron and the face of the slopes, hidden hills where there are houses set in amongst Kānaka and other vegetation on the lower slopes of Mount Iron. So you have to do, because of a 6-year system of the ONF, in my submission, you've got to step back and do a real world assessment, on when you are considering the overall issues, on to what extent will it be adverse to put in a particular view three or four more houses into a view which already has houses.
Mr. Goldsmith, a proposition that just went through my mind. Is this an example, because of the definitional issue you've just identified, where consideration against the district plan objectives, which use, I might say, ONFs in capitals, namely as identified on the map, produces a different and more confined inquiry than the Section 6B inquiry, which uses ONF in small initial caps, and to the extent of the difference, that is an example of the plan not reflecting Part 2, and therefore within one of the exceptions in Kingston and in Davidson. Now that's a very long and tortured question, but hopefully this hill has got all the links. I'm challenging Commissioner Monroe with the most tortured question asked in this hearing.
I think that's a winner.
If I understand the basis of your question is a suggestion that an ONF in the district plan is different from a Section 6B ONF.
Correct. Based on the submission you just made, the real world is the feature goes to the bottom.
I'm struggling with the concept, but how do you get there? A district plan could have a definition of an ONF which is different from the meaning in the Act.
Well, that's Commissioner McGrath's point. that it's a flaw in the plan,
yes,
that we may or may not have jurisdiction to fix because of Allenby's submission. We do have jurisdiction to alter where the lines on the map are. But that would then create another problem because of the mismatch in the policies that you've identified.
Yes.
And we also wouldn't address the point that the same issues arise in other ONFs, so not like Fairley Hill. And Jack's point, there are ONFs that are not in the rural zone. Something that you previously commented upon in another forum.
I can see why you asked me whether I withdraw that submission point. It might make life a lot easier for you.
I'm not encouraging you either way, but I do need a yes or no answer to that question because we need to know what our jurisdiction is.
Yes. So perhaps to finish up on that point.
Can I say we haven't given it to you yet? Yes or no?
Oh, no, I'm not even giving it,
you know.
I don't think about that
much.
Thank you.
Because of that plan, the submission was live, and we were to agree with it. However, we got there, and the only for our consideration went to the base. It might make it easier for us to agree with your real-world assessment argument of all of the existing houses.
Of course, kind of why the submission had to put in the first place. However, regardless of the outcome of that, and give it a run, I will come back to session 5. In my suggestion, if you're doing 6B, you're looking at the ONF, the run, let's say, as defined, but then when you come to weigh your overall weighing of factors, my suggestion, you can't ignore the overall view. And when we come to section 5 and enabling communities, etc., etc., the real world view, you must bring into the equation the real world view of what people are looking at and what people are seeing, and the fact that people can't see the zone boundary or another net boundary that's artificially partly up the slope. What they see is the real world.
To follow up on what you're talking about, the real world consideration versus section 6 and section 5 and the whole package of parts together. One of the questions I've been mulling over, having read all the evidence and the council reports and observed an interest recent jurisprudence, how do we approach the difference between a potential effect on an OEF or ONL for the purpose of section 6? And the effect on someone's view of that feature, which could be a section 7 amenity values issue, if the loss of a view from someone somewhere else has no actual discernible effect on the integrity of, in particular, say, an OE. How do I say so? In addition to section 5 and section 6, at what point is worrying about views not even about section 6, but their amenity values under section 7?
Quoting Judge Jackson, who talks about the cross-referencing and the overall and the put it all together.
Well, if we were to agree that things like views that people well away from the ONF might appreciate, if we were to think that was more of a Section 7 type of amenity value effect rather than a Section 6 effect, that might help us agree with your proposition of the real world evaluation and get over the complexity of where an ONF starts and stops, because we might not be thinking about an effect on an ONF as such.
You have to do both, obviously. You have to do section 6B, you have to do section 7. There's no priority between them. There's section 6 and section 7. There's had regard to versus where the other interrupting words are.
But recognise and provide for.
Recognise and provide for, yes. I think the belief, commissioners, the answer comes down to looking at those two separate considerations and then you have to be nothing around. And that must, to a degree, relate to the extent of effect. I mean, if the adverse effect on the ONF is significant and huge and that then influences your amenity outcome. Whereas, as I would argue in this case, looking at the artificial ONF, we are putting some houses there, there are three or four from this viewpoint and three or four from that viewpoint. If we're talking about visual, then you must examine the extent of the adverse effect on the ONF, and then go to section 7 and wider amenity. People's views of the mountain, it is an amenity issue. I'm not sure it's easy to draw a black line between those two considerations. They do overlap.
Well, we'll discuss it with Mr. Baxter that if one of the Pigeon Bay criteria is experiential values of, in this case, an ONF, and your experience of the ONF is adversely affected because it's got houses on it, that would be one route to get to a view that it's both. It's both the view and the ONF.
It is. I don't think there's any argument about the fact that there are effects on the ONF, and there's also quite a bit of weight on the driveways and networks. That's a physical effect on the ONF. If you can see a roof of a house changes your perception of it, but if you can't see the roof of the house, it changes your perception of the naturalness. Well, actually, it physically changes the naturalness to a certain extent, but to a physical degree. We are clearing 1.2 hectares of canoga. That's a change to the physical aspect of the ONF. We are doing other things for the better. But then when you go to experiential, and people's experience of Mount Iron, then you must end up falling back into visual and what they're looking at and how they react to it. And then of course you go to a subset of, well, some people think houses on the bad and some people actually quite like houses, so that gets difficult. And then of course experiential also brings in recreation and walking and a whole bunch of other ways to experience the area. And I don't know, at the end of the day, in this case, how you end up. If only you get anywhere at the end without doing some sort of balancing exercise.
Now, while you're on a balance, while you're balancing from foot to foot, King Cinnamon, you picked up that I inquired of Council for the Council whether she could point me to any authority applying what I call an environmental compensation approach in a planned setting, and you argued in your written submissions that it's bound up in part two. Pre-King Salmon, I would have agreed with you, and that I'm not so sure that it's right post-King Salmon because of what the Supreme Court had to say about the interrelationship between Section 6 and Section 5, and my even advanced theoretical view, but I'm not even sure that the cases of environmental compensation and resource consenting can be relied on post-King Salmon. So one of the questions I was going to have for you is whether you could point me to anything that has actually considered that aspect post-King Salmon, as opposed to the cases you point me to, which are all prior to the Supreme Court's contributions to jurisprudence.
Can I
ask you
that one too, sir?
Yes, I appreciate it. It's a big curveball. Yeah. But I would appreciate your assistance on it, because it seems to me that at the heart of your big objective is the question about whether we have the ability to entertain the big jigsaw that you've constructed. Like, there are separate issues about scope that will come to me, but if we're putting scope aside, whether the planning process, particularly King Salmon and what it had to say about the overall balance and where Section 6 fits in, I'd appreciate your assistance explaining to me how we can entertain that big objective in a planning framework post-King Salmon. So, big curveball, and I don't need I don't want your immediate reaction. I do want a considered view, and I will give you time to give me a response in writing if you want it, because it seems to me that's at the heart of everything you're seeking in this proposal.
Yes, at the heart. My instinctive reaction is if you can't achieve that in a district plan, then there's something badly wrong with either the act or the jurisprudence.
But one of the things, as you know, in a hierarchical court setting is we are mere mortals at the bottom of the pile looking up at the Supreme Court. We may have our views about what the Supreme Court tells us, but the one thing is there's still the Supreme Court.
And I think I suspect I would accept the invitation to do that in writing rather than
When you finish your case today, we'll discuss how many things are on your list and when you might be able to revert to us.
Yes, sir. Anyway, I'll finish off that with my landscape work. I was going to finish by saying, by submitting to you that in your 6B consideration, you will find guidance from Ms. Melhock. You'll also find guidance from Mr. Baxter. This is the visual landscape aspects of 6B. They have different views, you have to make a fact, finding the facts between them, but they both address that issue. However, my submission, when we go to the real world aspect of looking at Mount Iron and experiencing Mount Iron as a whole, including the smaller slopes outside the ONF, then you will find guidance from Mr. Baxter Evans, because he specifically addresses that wider picture, whereas with respect to Ms. Nelson, largely confines her assessment to an ONF 6B assessment, and at no point steps back and looks at Mount Iron with its houses on the lower slopes and talks about the effects of these proposed houses on that real world picture.
Now, Mr. Goldsmith, I've obviously discussed that with Mr. Baxter, and we have this tempting invitation for us to go and look and make up our own mind. And I have to say, speaking personally, not for my fellow commissioners, the thing that struck me as we did our site visit in that quadrant, and I understand what you're saying, that if you go over to Waterfall Creek and look back at Mount Iron, you do not see that in November. There are going to be a big semicircle where you're not going to see anything on those northern slopes. But if you're in North Lake, up at Spicky Forest, those houses on those northern slopes seem remarkably visible, and I might even say jar with my lay view of the landscape. And if the intent was that they be obscured and fit into the landscape, I'm not at all sure it succeeded.
You're talking existing houses?
Yes.
I'm not going to argue with that. I don't think they're specific. I'm not sure how strong the controls were that were applied to those houses and they were consented as design.
And so, better to say, just put down a marker that having invited us to consider that wider view based on what our own eyes are telling us, like, I have some concerns about overlaying more development with more effect on what to me is already a compromised feature.
And my response to that, I don't think it's Mr. Baxter's.
Yes. One of the reasons I'm telling you this is so that he can think about what his answer to that question is.
Well, I'm going to say 2 points. In actual fact, his evidence specifically addresses that issue, specifically distinguishes between what has been proposed and what is already there, talks about the additional design controls intended to achieve a different outcome from what is already there. So he does address that as evidence, and I invite you to explore that with him. But then again, and my second response is, Allenby is not saying that there will not be effects. We are not saying that from certain viewpoints that we will see some or more houses, to a greater or lesser degree depending on the colours and the vegetation, that there will be effects which some people would consider adverse. That's not disputed. But that's landscape position. There's a whole bunch of, I'm not going to repeat them all, but my written submissions on Pigeon Bay and the Pigeon Bay factors, shared and recognised experiential, ecological, when you are considering the effect on the ONF, and there's a real, I won't say danger, but it happens in this district, that the visual gets all of the attention, and the other aspects of an ONF get given, to be blunt, the amount of attention that the council evidence gives them, which is almost nothing. If you look at the ONF and the pigeon-bait factors, then there's landscape, there's ecological, there's recreational, they all must come into the frame. And we have, in my submission, a fairly, what is, inarguable in this case. It's landscape, visual, some adverse effects, ecological, undoubtedly beneficial effects, significant, recreational, undoubtedly beneficial effects, significant. Some point you're going to be weighed and balanced. Regardless, sorry, of just what I think, I'll make this quick, what I think about it. I think that is almost regardless of the jurisprudential issues of King's Hamlin in 65. Step right away from all of that, given you have a task to determine the zoning outcome which better achieves the relevant objectives and policies. And even accepting that your objectives and different objectives and policies are still fluid, even that confined space, I think I said my legal solutions, one outcome will better achieve some objectives and policies, the other outcome will better achieve other objectives and policies. There is no outcome that will better achieve all of the objectives and policies. So regardless of King's Hamlin or anything else, you're going to have to make that decision. And I don't think it's a counter thing. Counter landscape policies and counter ecological and counter recreationalist. There's different outcomes here, and whichever way you go, you'll achieve some better than others. I'll move on from landscape. Touch briefly on ecological. And again, I refer to the same page of Mr. Farr's evidence, page 49. This time, I refer to his paragraph 12.20.b. Two parts. He says the adverse effects on the ecological values of the SNA are not sufficiently mitigated by the proposed alternate SNA and mitigation of planting. I'm just going to put it to the evidence commissioners. When you read Mr. Davis' assessments and reports, and you read Dr. Lloyd's assessment and report, and the differences between the two in terms of quality and detail and assessment, my submission on the facts, it is not possible to come to conclusions about it.
Now, on that score, I think that your written submissions might be a little at cross purposes where the counsel's coming from, because I asked Mr. Davis the direct question that if he could only have one of these SNAs, which one would he have? Namely, the one that he's already got in the notified plan, or the one that Dr. Lloyd is recommending. He said the latter. So I don't think...
Well, Matt has said his written evidence says the opposite.
Well...
So
I think that you're pressing at an open door, but it also seems to me that there is... There is an issue as to whether we're asking the right question. Is it decisive that one is better than the other, or is the reality that they are both significant and one is more significant than the other? Now, that may be something you want to defer to Dr. Lloyd, who very carefully chooses his words, and I want to explore that with him. But what is your submission on that point?
Well, I'm glad to hear about that concession by Mr. Davis, because I struggled to understand his written report, which said the opposite. I couldn't see how he could get there. I'm glad he's rethought that, because on facts, it must be better. secondly, on the evidence, Mr. Dr. Wood, as I understand it, he specifically comments on his view of the significance of the discard area, if I call it that, the part we're taking out of the SLA. He talks about it being modified and some houses and no particular ecological values there apart from powder. He differentiates between the area, the discard area, and the alternate area quite strongly. And thirdly, I make the point that in any event, of the 10 point something hectares of Kānaka within the zone, 1.2 hectares has been removed, and I think Mr. White's going to have to produce a calculation that says we're refarming 1 hectare. So I'm not sure there's a big significance in the sense that although an area has been taken out of the SNA, the zone that has been proposed provides stronger protection than the SNA provides to 90% of the vegetation within the discard area. So effectively, the council is getting the best protocols. You get the alternate SNA, which everybody now agrees to the bigger SNA, and 90% of the rest of it has been protected.
Now, in terms of what's mapped as an SNA, another aspect I appreciate assistance from you all is that I was alerted by a recent Christchurch decision in the High Court saying that identification of SNAs is a matter for ecologists, not for planners. And that in turn referenced back to earlier cases on the west coast about wetlands to the same effect. Hence, in effect, applying a man of war logic to ecological areas, they don't talk about the planning provisions until you've identified what it is you're talking about, and you identify it by an ecological assessment. Now, is your argument falling foul of that principle by blurring the planning and the ecological assessment rather than treating them sequentially?
I would argue no, sir, because if you read Dr. Lloyd's detailed report, where he goes through all of the required criteria in both the proposed plan and the operative plan, I think, and there's a bunch of headings there by which you assess the different values of ecological aspects. He provides a detailed assessment, and on that detailed assessment he arrives at a recommended SNA. And that's purely an ecological exercise. My original concern was Mr. Davis somehow ignoring that. Sorry, was Mr. Davis coming to a different conclusion without waiting to see any evidence. And Mr. Barr preferred Mr. Davis. Now we seem to have fixed that up. In this case, I would argue that now Mr. Davis has accepted the ultimate SNA. We have a purely ecological assessment from basis of the SNA. And that has not been influenced by planning considerations.
Something like I read with interest Dr. Lloyd's reports at his residence, and your categorisation is of course completely accurate. But what Dr. Lloyd didn't say was the discount there, discount area was not significant on an ecological test, which is what I was looking for. And if he did say it, I'll be interested in him pointing that out to me, because I must have missed it, which is, I'm hoping to be incorrect, of course, because it seemed that he was employing a relativistic test, which the cases that I read from the West Coast said was not the right test, but it might all be significant.
I'll let him answer that question when he comes, although I seem to recollect he said at some point that if all of the Kāmaka in the zone was removed, it wouldn't adversely affect the ecological values of the UCA. Just about, apart from the little bit he cut out. I thought he said that, but clearly you put the question, that's for him, so it's for him to answer, not me. And I'm happy to defer someone.
And while you're, it may not be quite so easy to defer the next one. Which is, and what are we to make of the finding of the environment, well, the district court as it was, that the areas of cleared vegetation were, quote, significant, unquote, in the course of the sentencing decision?
Context is different. Clearly, a mistake was made, and I touched on it in my legal submissions, and that was accepted by the court. There's a lack of understanding of the fact that the rules were in place. The blunt facts were, if I were to collect, you could remove 50 square metres of bush without consent. Something like 9,000 square metres of bush were removed. So it was significant in a quantitative sense. We have to go back and look at the sentencing notes here. We'll look at lunch as to whether the court was addressing significance in an ecological sense or significance in a quantitative sense. But he did cite the court, as I remember, who reflects to what was part of the bush removed here.
Yes, and like, I know exactly what you mean, because His Honour clearly said, well, there's a difference in quantity, but it's so far over the trigger it makes no difference.
Correct, yes.
I think that I do need your assistance on that, because my reading of the sentencing notes was that he was applying a qualitative test. So if you think that's not, my reading is incorrect, you need to tell me why that is.
I'll do so, sir. I was still
I can see you're going to have a busy lunch.
I would add, though, sir, that's a district plan forum sentencing exercise where the facts are undisputed, a guilty plea being entered, and the court was reacting with the size of fine and taking into account all other factors. Regardless of what that court may have said, I would submit that. That is a forum different from this forum. This is an environment, an RMA forum, where your attention is directed to RMA considerations, and that district court finding whatever it is on whatever basis it was, my submission cannot be binding on this panel.
I wonder if I could ask you, because this might solve the issue. Can I ask you to provide to us the agreed facts on which the sentencing notes were applied? Because His Honour made the point in a number of cases that he wasn't prepared to entertain submissions outside the agreed facts, some of which went in favour of Allenby and some of which didn't. But I think it would be helpful because, as you said, if it was a position on undisputed facts, I want to know what those facts that were not disputed were.
I don't actually have that, but I'm sure we get it.
You're able and dedicated junior, I think I'm sure we'll have it all under control. And I'm not saying right this minute, but well, I appreciate the offer to get an electronic copy over lunch. It's not that urgent, but I would appreciate you providing it there to us.
The only other aspect of ecological I was going to raise was again the same paragraph 12.20 little d, the second part of the sentence where Mr. Barr said that the proposal would not protect an area of significant indigenous vegetation in terms of section 60 of the Act. I was going to make some concern of the fact that it's a half quote and it's also significant habitat of indigenous fauna in 60. And as Dr. Lloyd has typically found that there's significant habitat of indigenous fauna in the alternate SNA, but not in the notified SNA. But given Mr. Davis' acknowledgement that it's a better SNA anyway, that's what I'm talking about.
The other comment that might be made is that Dr. Lloyd found some significant indigenous herbivora in the area to the north, which he then carved out of the discard area. So,
correct.
So that in response to Dr. Lloyd's investigation, so one might say that Mr. Barr's observation was correct at the time you made it, and you've tweaked your relief to make it incorrect. All right, I'm not saying that that was improper, but in a sense you're both right, is what I'm getting at. It was right at the time that Mr. Barr made a comment, and he shifted the ground to address it.
Well, I think that the point I was making was that there's no reference to indigenous fauna in there.
Yes.
And mostly valuable indigenous fauna were on the lower slopes. But anyway, we seem to be on the same page. It's a better SNA. And that possibly resolves that issue. Of course, it's a wider issue of the... So far. I'll finish off by saying, on the evidence before you in my submission, that there can be no doubt that the proposal will result in beneficial ecological outcomes and notified zoning, particularly in relation to active management of modern conifers, and that there can be no doubt that confirmation of the zone would better achieve the directive of section 6C and all relevant objectives and policies and whatever can happen in relation to ecological matters. And then to the recreation. Clearly, on the case that you have been presented with, it is a significant issue. I'd argue in a real world sense, if you think about how many people enjoy and appreciate the benefits of saving lizards and how many people enjoy and appreciate the benefits of being able to walk over Mount Iron, that's probably more significant than the ecological issue. And given the basis on which the case has been presented, I submit that the panel must have some concerns that aspect being the witnesses on the radar for the council's experience. And this was one sentence of Mr. Barr's evidence in paragraph 12.38 where he makes a passing reference to the positive benefits of information. But given its significance in this case, in my submission, it warranted a lot more consideration. What I find puzzling, I have to say, is why Mr. Barr didn't pick up Dr. Galloway's evidence, walk down the corridor or across the road to the council's Parks and Recreation Department and seek some advice. He could have done that. He could have said, gone across the corridor and said, look, I've got this case here. It's raising public recreation as a big benefit for Wanaka. I need some guidance on it. How significant is that benefit? Oh, sorry, is it a benefit? Okay. Question number one, is it a benefit? Question number two, it's a benefit. How significant is that benefit? Number three, how does it work in with the council's plans on recreation aspects of the future of Wanaka? I need advice on that from an expert. Because, speaking as I was just about, I don't have that expertise myself. And it is a mystery to me as to why that wasn't done. Because you will appreciate, commissioners, that there's a two-step process here. First of all, in terms of recreation, one must assess the significance or value of the recreational outcomes. I don't know if there's any argument that they're positive. Can't be any argument on that. How positive? How significant? How important is it? That's the first step. Obviously, same for the landscape, same for ecology. And then there's a second step. Weighing those competing, potentially competing considerations. You can't do the second step without the first step. And in my submission, Mr. Maher's failure to obtain any expert advice or critique of Dr. Galloway's evidence has two significant consequences for your consideration. Firstly, in my submission, you cannot place little if any weight on Mr. Maher's, shall I call it, his overall assessment, where he balances the one against the other, because he's failed to carry out that essential first step. And the second consequence, as stated by the submission, is that Dr. Galloway's evidence stands unchallenged. And he's described the benefits, he's described what could be achieved, and there was no challenge for that. So you have that evidence to assist you to weigh its value. That's the only evidence you have to weigh its value. And then you'll eventually go to the next step, which is weighing the competing value. So I have to say, recreational matters, commissioners, on you may have questions not to go away, but it is here, those things. Coming towards the end here, I want to make a brief comment on the fire protection. And again, I just ask this panel to take the real world into account. I was going to pace out 10 metres across this room, but I forgot to. But 10 metres is a reasonable distance. We have tightened up the rules, ignoring the fact that there are houses stuck up on Mount Iron that are surrounded by car and no one seems to mind.
Including Mr. Clues.
Including Mr. Clues. the system is strange. We don't have towering 50, 60, 70 metre tall stands of eucalyptus, which, you know, 40 degree temperatures and raging winds and trees which explode into flame and burn up suburbs. This is what, and it's coming. And 10 metres is quite here. And I just, let's not overread my submission, overread this issue. It's been raised, I have to say, that the council's two different briefs, that you two different documents, learn a bit more about fire prevention, which were actually very useful. We've tightened the distance, we've limited the species inside the 10 metres of broadleaf, which is the low flammability species, probably more than anybody else around for preventing fire. My submission is not a major issue.
Mr. Goldsmith, at the aspect of the fire point, I sat on the natural hazards stream and of the district plan, and we heard a submission about fire and the need to place greater emphasis on it as a natural hazard. Now that's just sitting alongside. But one point that the submitter prayed and aid of his mission was that there are areas of the district that have been settled, subject to residential settlement, that fire engines cannot reach and will not go up. And specifically he mentioned Hidden Hills. And so the question for you and your witness team, particularly the infrastructure team, is will the design of the access roads for the proposed residential development be accessible to emergency services, particularly fire services? And if they're not, what significance should we give to that fact?
Well, the short answer, I'll let this
answer. Well, again, that's me giving you a curveball in order that your witness has time to think about it.
I have heard about that once. Excellent. We have no concerns on that. But I'll let you go. You have to design in accordance with council standards or grades and gradients and you've got roads here, you're going to have to get concrete trucks, something, builders' trucks, and fire engines are pretty accessible. I'll let the experts answer that. We aren't dealing with it. I acknowledge that there are areas in this district that have challenges. But in our submission, this isn't one of them. I'd be curious to, just before I think of that, when you said Hidden Hills, do you know whether you're talking about the main, what I call Hidden Hills Drive, the big road that goes up, or are we talking about some accesses off? Was that specified?
Wasn't that specific.
I'd just be very surprised if it's, can't imagine how it could possibly be Hidden Hills Drive.
Well, at this point, I should disclose that Commissioner Hudson and I had a private site visit where we parked my car on Hidden Hills Drive and strolled up Council Easement to admire the view. I can understand, I suspect it was one of the sidelines.
Yes, I can't imagine the problem with Hidden Hills Drive. I mean, it's a major road built to council standards. It's a subdivision. I mean, council won't approve a major road like that, you can't get fire pits up. So it must be an offshoot. And there are some offshoots in this district where you wouldn't get fire truck. My next point is again a fairly short one. It relates to complexity, and I again refer to the same page, Mr. Barr's evidence, page 49, this time paragraph 12.19. I previously referred to this comment on the 8 pages of objectives and rules. And then he says, while I accept that this is not a reason alone to decline the zoning, it is not my view efficient or appropriate resource management practice. And I consider that Mr. White has overlooked the costs, efficiency and effectiveness of this approach in the section 32 evaluation. Now, my first point is that there doesn't in fact any analysis of the alleged costs, efficiency or effectiveness, disadvantages of what's proposed. But then I address it further and say, well, if we accept there's a cost to get to this point, which I'm sure there is, that's Calumby Farms' cost. That should be a concern to this panel. Yes, there's a cost of a one-day hearing here and a decision. That's a small cost for the community. But going forward, if it was approved, there'd be a subdivision, there'd be services, there'd be ecological management and so on, all private, all the development. All the other purchases, not a concern. And then you look at the outcome, and I would suggest to you that if the zone is approved generally in the form proposed, it would be hard to find the zone easier to administer. It's the most prescriptive zone I've ever seen. First subdivision plan must comply with 6 or 7 requirements. Almost no discretion for council. It's got to sort out the ecological management plan, not complicated. It's got to sort out recreation plan, not complicated. So subdivision gets approved, and people have applied for control activity consent for a house. Complex getting there, complex to create, and in terms of costs, efficiency and effectiveness of ongoing administration, I said that it would be one of the easiest, cheapest, most efficient zones ever created. I submit to you there is no basis in that aspect of Mr. Parr's report that it should be of concern to you. I'm going to finish my opening submission now. Commissioners, just to return to the objective legal points to one side, which we'll address. It is a very unusual objective, because I would suggest sure you all have a lot of experience in district land hearings. You probably haven't often come across a situation like this. It has been complex to achieve. A lot of thoughts gone into it. It is, in many sense, a unique outcome. If approved, and I include in that an acknowledgement to the Department of Conservation and our consultation. There's kind of a half an issue that looking after Mount Ion isn't their core business. It's a public park. A dock doesn't do birds and things and mollusks and killer possums. A whole range of things. Looking after public parks isn't usually their core business. They very much like council to take it over. And we started to think about, well, let's look towards the future. And in my submission, it is important under the RMA not to abandon the concept of looking to the future. There is a possible future here where 10 or 15 or 20 years' time, whenever we have one of our government size is now surrounded by people the council thinks would like to run down by, actually own it as a public park, look after it. We have got some effort to create a scenario where that can be easily achieved, in the sense that if the zone was confirmed in its current form and the subdivision was implemented, and council came along and said, well, we'd like to run this as a public park, two landowners have to agree. Dock will sign on the dotted line in an instant. And the landowner who was owning the whole of this, the rest of the land, and is looking after it, managing it, will also sign on the dotted line in an instant. And that is why the rule about requiring a lot with at least one building platform to own all of the two protection areas is to enable that future outcome. It's a forward-looking zone, it's thinking about the future, it's thinking about a public benefit. In a major, as I said in my opening, an urban park in the middle of a town. So I'd like to think that the council in the future will actually seriously look at that. Doesn't matter if the council doesn't. The zone is confirmed, the land will be there, accessible to the public, being looked after. Finish up by coming back to assuming we can get there, part two of section five, and ask the panel almost a simple question of all the issues that you have to weigh up in terms of communities providing for their well-being, etc. And the values of Mount Ion, simplistically, how many people do you think might look at two or three or four extra houses on Mount Ion, set in an area of the northern slopes where there's other houses, where you yourself, Commissioner, said it's already compromised? How many people would look and take into account of Mr. Baxter's design controls and dark rooms and so on? How many people would, in the future, would look there and say, oh gosh, that's a pity about those three or four houses or five or six houses? That shouldn't have happened. Compared to how many people, like, particularly recreationally, walk over Mount Ion, enjoy its benefits, recreation management plan, rock climbing, walks, maybe mountain biking, maybe not. At the end of the day, it's a pretty simple thing, sometimes RMA. who's going to benefit, how many people will benefit, and what is the outcome? What is the outcome that will better benefit community-wide? My submission to you, well, I'll leave you to make that decision. Commissioners, my submission to you is a very good case being presented. What has been requested and proposed would better achieve all relevant objectives and policies, you know, planning sense, the Act, and in a real world sense, the people like. Finally, commissioners, I'm anticipating there might be a bit of to and fro on plan provisions. So at this stage, the latest version is the version attached to my legal submissions with the red highlighting, the highlighting showing we made the last changes. Following anything else that comes out of this hearing, I would ask that the league to deliver the council a final suite of plan provisions. I decided not to do it now because it may be questions that may be the changes.
Can I assume that you'd prefer us to ask Mr. White questions about the amended planning provisions next to your submissions?
I think I'll have Mr. White sitting beside me anyway, and we're probably a two-team.
Well, in that case, I think the way we'll handle that is that we'll ask Mr. White for his planning opinion, and you might have something to contribute. But I don't want to ask you a whole raft of questions and ask Mr. White the same questions.
No, the same. I mean, maybe I've had a lot of input into those languages trying to make it work legally, because actually, in my experience, often the lawyer needs to be heavily involved in drafting the family reasons to try and just get it right and avoid unexpected outcomes. I think if you save those questions, then we'll see you next time.
We'll take the morning adjournment back at 11:45. We will have some questions for you. As I say, Mr. Goldsmith, I'd like to discuss scope issues with you in particular.